Well, thanks ever so much for joining us for this week's Tech Law 10. I'm Jonathan Armstrong. I'm speaking to you from the UK. And Eric, you're on too.
My name is Eric Sinrod. I'm Jonathan's partner based in San Francisco. We're ready to rock you in the iTech legal world.
Fantastic. And I think we've both been out and about speaking at conferences this week. And Eric, you've been speaking at iTech Law. What pearls of wisdom did you have there?
Well, thank you. Yes, last week, about a week ago from today, I did speak at the World Annual iTech Law Conference in San Francisco, and my topic was freedom or not of speech on the Internet. And to boil it down, as I need to because our calls here and our podcasts are relatively short, I explain that, you know, at least here in the United States, there is a protected free speech right under the First Amendment of our Constitution to speak freely and openly on the Internet and to be able to do so anonymously. And oftentimes, as you know, people will use emails that don't say exactly who they are. They'll use pseudonyms on, you know, Internet postings, not disclosing their real name. And I think we've mentioned this before, but you know, most of us have seen, you know, the cartoon character, you know, the cartoon drawing, you know, on the Internet, nobody knows you're a dog. You literally could be a dog and communicating on the Internet, and people might think you're a 40-year-old man, let's just say. The question comes up, does that give people impunity to say whatever they want on the Internet based on these protections? And even though here in the United States we do have great protections for speech, if that speech actually causes, is negative, is false, and causes harm to somebody else, there can be legal redress. Somebody could come back on them for defamation of character, for example. But what do you do if you don't know who it was that made that, that posted that comment that was so detrimental that's maybe, you know, caused your business to suffer? What would the normal procedure is, there would be a subpoena issued to the relevant ISP, Internet Service Provider, asking for the true identity of the poster. The ISP would then give a certain amount of notice to the true poster saying, look, you know, we are going to comply with legal process and unmask you and give your identity to the requesting party unless you take it upon yourself to file what's called a motion to quash this particular subpoena. And then there's a balancing test under a case called Dendrite. It was a Dendrite was a case that emanated out of New Jersey, and it sort of set forth this balancing test. But at the end of the day, it requires the harmed party to come forward with what's called a prima facie case. They have to show that they have a pretty good chance of winning if they go to trial, that, you know, these statements really were made on the Internet, and, you know, here's the true quantifiable harm that's been suffered. If they can come forward with a sufficient showing, a prima facie case, the judge then will unmask. Now, I once had a case where my client posted something on a Yahoo Finance bulletin board about a financial management house out of Boston. They sought his identity, saying that his statement caused them harm, and their argument was that their share price had dropped after his statement. Well, we actually established on the motion that their share price had gone up, and as a consequence, my client was not unmasked. His identity was not revealed. It can go, you know, the real question is, you know, is there tangible harm that can be proven up? And then there's been an interesting wrinkle, if you're interested, Jonathan. Sometimes, you know, in our country, we really don't like prior restraints of speech. And when I spoke at this conference, my co-speaker was Lawrence Wilson, who's the general counsel of Yelp. And he made a pretty passionate argument about, or against, I should say, agreements that are now showing their way into the doctor-patient relationship, whereby, you know, when a patient comes in and, you know, maybe they're in distress, they've been injured, they're sick, and they're asked to sign a number of forms, which they just do hardly without even reading, you know, one of the forms that's showing up appears, at least by its title, to relate to protecting the patient's confidentiality, but when you actually look at the text, the patient is agreeing not to comment upon publicly or disclose, you know, his or her feelings about the nature of the medical service that's been provided. So in such a world, if you went to a particular doctor who committed, you know, medical malpractice upon you, you couldn't review that doctor on Yelp or say anything otherwise on the negative on the Internet. Your speech would be chilled, and Lawrence was, you know, not in favor of those agreements and truly wonders whether they're enforceable, and even said he would welcome any lawsuit that a doctor might bring against Yelp if there were such a posting in violation of such an agreement. What's your take?
I think we've got similar issues over here. We talked last week about superinjunctions. That podcast is still available for download, www.bit.ly/techlaw10, if you don't know the link already. There have been really quite a lot of developments on the superinjunctions, which is sort of a bit of the same area this week. We've had a 112-page report just published on open justice, so these type of issues. The catchy title of this very readable report, I say readable because one of our senior judges has produced it, so therefore it must be a great piece of work, is Report of the Committee on Superinjunctions, Superinjunctions, Anonymized Injunctions and Open Justice. And it is looking at this particular balance. I spoke also at Perfect Info, a conference over here this week, and we had a very good panel discussion. And one of the things that I was talking about, which I think is relevant, is there is a real habit of people reviewing things. You know, TripAdvisor would be an example where people review restaurants. Obviously, professional services come in that same trend as well. In the UK, there is possible class action litigation against a site called Solicitors from Hell, which reviews lawyers immediately after consultations. And I think one of the real challenges, from my point of view, and I said this at the conference, was that the tools that we use to review people also get instant. So, for example, let's take TripAdvisor. People, I guess, used to review the meal they'd had yesterday. Now, because connectivity is much more ubiquitous, they review the meal they've just had. And as people get, it becomes more socially acceptable to use your iPhone in a restaurant. And as people get more irritated, they don't talk to their friends about it. They talk to their device about it. They talk to TripAdvisor about it. Mm-hmm. So I think we're getting to the stage where people, for example, in a restaurant, are reviewing the meal mid-meal. And if you upset those people, particularly if, you know, they're, the phrase we use, English is tired and emotional, particularly if they've had a liquid element to the meal as well, maybe their usual judgment isn't as accurate as it might be. And I think we see this in a whole host of areas. There's a case study of a hotel in Scotland that was getting, I think, fairly average reviews, so they decided to act upon them. And the job of the manager each morning is to go on TripAdvisor, look at the reviews they've had of the hotel, and either do something about it or thank people if they've given a good review. And I think from what you're saying, Eric, even the medical profession is feeling that they have to address this issue. But your question, I think, is the right one. Are they going to fight against the tide by trying to legally prohibit people from reviewing what they're doing? Or are they better advised to engage more properly in social media, you know, subject to client confidentiality, to be able to put their side of the case and take some valid criticisms on board and respond to them? Is that a better way ahead, Eric?
Well, that's a, as I would say in the law, a compound question with many parts. and as we're running out of time, my response is this, I suppose. I mean, yes, there are many strategies to deal with this. I mean, even short of litigation, obviously. You know, I've represented some professional baseball players, and there were some negative derogatory comments made about them on the Internet. And then my question
we
was...
We call that rounders, by the way. For the English people listening, we call that rounders.
Very good. And I asked, you know, we really probed and there was no real harm suffered. And I guess my point on this is, you know, any particular comment on the Internet right now could be just a grain of sand on a vast beach. And it might just get lost in all the other noise. So if it's not really rising to the top and causing real harm, in some ways you don't want to fan the flames and draw attention to it. But if it is, you know, out there and it's a red flag or a sore thumb or whatever metaphor you want to use, you know, sometimes drafting a response to it, you know, dealing with the person who's aggrieved, and maybe all of a sudden they feel better and they post something nicer. Clearly, thanking people that say something favorable is nice. It's good business. But you're right. I think there's a knee-jerk reaction now to have these reviews, And so hopefully, at least for any reputable, well-meaning business, if there is a negative comment, somebody didn't like the soup at the restaurant, hopefully there are going to be 25 comments that are positive and reflecting good value there. So I think we've run the course here. We're over 10 minutes. This is a topic that we could talk about again. We certainly have more topics we want to discuss, and we're clearly open to any suggestions that our followers have, so feel free to email us. I'm E.J. Sinrod at DwayneMorris.com. Jonathan?
I'm J.P. Armstrong at DwayneMorris.com. If you do want a copy of that 112-page report, just email me. I can send you a copy. It's also linked as a PDF from my Twitter account, which is ArmstrongJP. Eric, you're on Twitter as well?
Yes, I am. I don't have it right off the top of my head, though, like you do. He's always trying to best me, and he did.
But you can find Eric on Facebook.
Facebook, under my name.
We're on LinkedIn.
And LinkedIn.
All right. And if you're listening to these podcasts currently on the web and you'd prefer them on iTunes, you can find us on iTunes as well now. And with that, I guess we just sign off. We say thank you for listening and see you next week.
Thank you.